This is the Authentic Persuasion Show. Hey, everybody. Jason Cutter here. Welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show. My special guest today is Mike Testa from Max Approvals. Super excited that Max is going to be on the show. He works in a field and a line of work that I'm semi-familiar with, but then also have zero experience with, which I think is fascinating and fun. So he is one of the pioneers of patient financing. So he was the president and one of the owners of Care Credit, which if you've ever been to a doctor or a dentist and you've seen that out there, you know that that kind of financing is available to help you cover the costs that maybe you can't with insurance. He helped grow it to over $100 million a year in loan origination, or from $100 million to over $5 billion, which then sold to GE. He's been in this space dealing with dental finance, consulting with companies. He's focused on Max Approvals and helping in the patient finance space. And I know that some of the stuff that we're going to talk about is both internal sales operations and how to support your internal salespeople, and then this fascinating world of, you know, B2B and helping that, which is then B2B to C, because then those, you know, medical practitioners then selling that to patients and how that all works. Mike, welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show.
Thank you, Jason Cutter, the hardest working man or woman in sales training. Oh my God. You are all over the place, dude. I see podcasts and seminars and in-person training. And half of the stuff's for free. How do you do it?
I appreciate that. I don't know how I do it. On one side of my brain, people think that I'm crazy because of how much I do. On the other side, it's funny because I'm like, I feel like I should be doing more. There was a point in time where I'm doing a 5 day a week podcast, and there I have another friend of mine who does seven, and I was like, maybe I should do 7 to 10. Like Gary Vee says, you should be doing more. And I'm like, hey, I think I might do 10 a week. And I talked to my buddy. He's like, well, that's cool, because I'm now doing 14 episodes a week. And I'm like, dang it, like I just feel lazy with only what I do, and obviously. Yeah, and he didn't mean to. He was just like, yeah, I'm doing more. And I'm like, man. And I don't know, part of it is just I love sharing this stuff. And, you know, when it resonates, the right people want to tune in. So I appreciate that. And, you know, part of it is just super self-centered and greedy. It's my only child side, where I just want to have conversations with guests on the show, people like you. I want to learn. I take lots of notes. So the more I can have these conversations and put it under podcast, the more, you know, just get that stuff out there. And, you know,
yeah, well, you're doing great work. I listen to it all the time. Congratulations. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mike. And that means a lot, considering your background, all the stuff that you've done, the space that you play in, you know, thinking about you being a part of Care Credit, which is a brand that most people know, sometimes unfortunately, as a patient with some kind of bill that you have to cover, but at least familiar with that as a as an option and whatnot. Let's
yeah, a great show. Company that, you know, I'll tell you, just, you know, just a little aside, you know, we built a great brand there, but I swear to God, to this day, the success of that company was built on two people, and they were both salespeople, Doug Hammond and Tony Seymour. Doug ran dental and veterinary, the veterinary side markets, and Tony ran cosmetic surgery and ophthalmology, and they were more than 50% responsible for building that whole business.
Wow. So let's talk about that, because obviously this is the Authentic Persuasion Show, which is focused on sales, sales leaders, sales operations. And I know that, you know, one of the things that we wanted to talk about was both scaling sales ops and what you're seeing in practices and also in the patient finance world, but then also what you learned and saw from that Care Credit side. What was some of the keys to success for both those two gentlemen, as well as like the sales operation as a whole with, you know, what you were involved with?
Yeah, well, you know, we were a sales and marketing company. So the loans were done by GE and Citibank at the time. You know, they were doing all the operations. So our job was to enroll practices and get them to use the product. So it was pure sales. And, you know, it struck me when, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier, but all the things that you say that makes a successful salesperson, building trust, authentic persuasion, all those qualities, they apply to a company too. You know, what can a company do to make life easier for their salespeople? And that's, you know, that's what I relate back to into how we built Care Credit. So, you know, there was a couple things. First of all, for us, was talk the talk of the market. Understand who your customer is. We were in medical, right? Mostly in dental. So they're not called customers. They're called patients. Dentists don't talk about revenue. They use the term production. So, and when we went into the veterinary field, you couldn't use the term patient because the patient was the animal, right? So you use the term clients. I spent, geez, a tremendous amount of time early on editing every marketing piece that went out to make sure that the tone, not the creator, the tone and the language was appropriate for the market that we were dealing in, because that's how you build trust. You know, you use generic terms or words that they're not familiar with, they're not used in the industry, and people think of you as an outsider. So, you know, early on, I think that was important for us. You know, the second thing that I felt real strongly about was go big or go home. You know, we went to numerous trade shows, over 100 a year. We did a lot of advertising, but it really, right from the start, you know, I made sure that we were making a big presence. Buy full page ads, not quarter page ads, and be consistent. You know, be there every month. If you go to a trade show, continue to attend, because the first time you miss, people say, well, "Where? What happened to them? Right? Are they out of business?" And don't get some dinky little 10x10 booth in the back by the bathroom, right? You know, go with a 20x20 booth and make a presence. So if you can't go big, don't do it. And you know, that's how we kind of established Care Credit in the marketplace. But I probably the most important thing in my mind that put Care Credit on the board, and obviously Tony and Doug had a lot to do with it, is back to this establishing trust. So we had made relationships with people that dentists trust. I got the exclusive endorsement of the American Dental Association, all the state associations. We were endorsed by the practice management consultants, folks that dentists listen to and look to for advice. They were partners with us. So, you know, we would send out, close to a million pieces of direct mail a month. And the direct mail didn't come from Care Credit. They came from the American Dental Association. So, of course, they're going to open it up, which, right, is the first challenge. Same thing with email or any other form of communication. Will they read what your pitch is? They open it up. Inside there's a letter from the executive director of American Dental Association saying, hey, these guys are great. Check them out. You should try them. Establishing trust. Trust with people that they know and you know, they're familiar with in the industry. And they see the trade shows. I mean, you know the old adage, it takes 6, 7, 8, 10 impressions before they remember you. That was a big part of what Care Credit did.
So I love that. There's so much to unpack in all of that. Working backwards, in a sense, I love what you're talking about with getting endorsed by the people that your potential market trusts. In this case, who do dentists, who do doctors go to or rely on or see as a trusting body? I think that's good for sales and sales organizations to understand that and align with that. I know that's one of the things I focus on. It's not necessarily going straight to companies who might need my help, but who out there is service providers to them? Who else is somebody they trust? And then who, you know, is a good person to align with? I love what you said about going to conferences, going to shows, being there over and over again. Because I know from going to enough conferences that, you know, you go to a conference, you meet somebody and you're like, all right, is this person serious? Are they going to be here next year? And if they're there next year, okay, great, like this person's still around. Otherwise, especially in some of the conferences I go to, there's a lot of people who come and go that talk big game or promise lots of stuff, and they're full of, you know, hot air, and then they disappear, right? Or nobody trusts them anymore. And so I think that's important on those two points alone.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's how we built the business. It was gave us a leg up in the industry, and you know, much more visibility versus our competition, because you're always, you know, you're competing. At the time, we were competing with a lot of folks. I mean, we were early in the industry, but I was competing with Citibank, Chase, Cap One. They're all gone, right? Yeah. They all dropped out. We were a consistent presence. And if there's any industry or market that doesn't trust business people, it's doctors, right? They all think you're there to take advantage of them. So that trust level is super, super important.
So I think the biggest part that you talked about was building trust in the same way that you would with a potential client, customer, whatever that looks like, but looking at it from an internal perspective. And it's one of the things where, you know, I say, A, everything is in life is sales, and B, sales is about leadership of somebody, right? So when you're a really good salesperson, you're actually leading that prospect to a better place with or without you, but you're leading them. And same thing in an organization, leaders obviously leading, and a lot of people don't see the correlation. So how does that happen? So you brought up this point that most people don't put together, which is, you know, selling and leading a team internally the same way you would build trust and all of those things. How did that come about, or where did that come from, or how did you maintain that from the top down, especially as a company grows? Because it's one thing to do it when it's small, when it's a few people. It's another one as you scale. A lot of times that corporate culture gets watered down, you lose touch with it, and then it just becomes like this factory where people don't know anybody anymore, and nobody, you know, cares the same way as they used to.
Yeah, tell me about it. I mean, it was tough, especially when we got bought by GE, right? Talk about a culture, corporate culture. They certainly had their culture. The first thing they wanted to do was change the name to GE Money. And I said, that ain't going to happen. So we started out, you know, on that kind of foot. But as in all businesses, it starts with hiring the right people. And, you know, you asked about those sales folks. They came from the market. You know, Doug knew everybody there was in dental. Tony worked for Alcon. He was selling LASIK machines to these doctors. They knew ophthalmology. They knew veterinary. They knew the dental market. They didn't know anything about finance. Neither do I. I still to this day don't know what a basis point is, right? But I know dentists. Right? I know veterinarians, I know ophthalmologists, I know cosmetic surgeons, and those guys knew those markets. They were able to talk the talk, they were able to establish trust, they were able to guide us with what would work and what wouldn't work and what the prospects wanted. And that, you know, that was the culture that we established. We were externally focused. I used to tell people, you know, in meetings, there's nothing that happens inside of these four walls that makes a difference. Everything happens that is important happens outside in the marketplace. So get out there, talk to customers, learn from the customers what they want, do two things real well, continue to improve the product week after week, day after day, and sell. Those are the two things that are important for a company that starts out. But, you know, like you said, as you grow bigger, you know, those demons start chipping away at that sales culture that you build. You just got to keep, you know, I call it protecting the salespeople. Even within our own organization, I would have people accuse me of being favorites with sales. Oh, they get all the trips, right? They get all the commissions. They make all the money. I used to say, hey, I got an opening. You know, if you're interested, apply.
That's it.
Right? You think you can do it? more power to you, because, you know, I couldn't. It's a tough job. But those initial salespeople that we hired coming from the market, they built great teams. Hiring folks, you know, Bette Johnson's still there today. She came in, she knew every practice management consultant, every association, and it's still the core of the relationships that they built. So it's important to hire the right people early on and then continue to protect them as you grow and be true to the customer.
So when it comes to hiring the right people, both, you know, obviously we're talking a lot about your time at Care Credit, but you are, you know, an extension of that and focusing on consulting and working in this patient finance space still. How do you hire, or how did you find the right way, or what did the team do to hire the right people so you could scale, right? Like, and not just somebody who then knew every dentist out there, but there's more than just the golden Rolodex, if you will, but somebody who is also aligned with the sales process you have, the values, what you stand for, you know, right. and being effective. Like, how do you do that at scale?
Right, right. Well, you know, you build the team from the top down. You know, it's hiring the right direct reports, and you know, you don't always make the right hire, right? But you know, I was a firm believer in constant and consistent communication. So every week I had a block of time set aside, same time each day with each of my direct reports for an hour. They would come in, we would sit, we would talk about anything they wanted to talk about, whatever. You know, I had a list of things I wanted to ask them about, so you know, that we could continue to be aligned with what we're trying to accomplish and the culture that we were trying to build. I had quarterly meetings with all employees, hands on deck, be honest about where our successes were, where our failures were, what we were trying to do, and then twice a year I met with every employee for an hour. Every one of them. And again, you know, have them come back at me, tell me what's going on in the marketplace, what do they see as important. And then, you know, you establish this relationship of trust again with your employees. They open up to you, and you in kind support them. And that's how you build a team.
How? I'm thinking about all these meetings that you had with people, super valuable, FaceTime, getting feedback, obviously giving some feedback, but getting from them some information. How did you filter, or what did you use as some kind of barometer for what feedback to listen to, who to listen to? You know, because everyone's got opinions, but doesn't mean you necessarily want to take them all to heart. Right? Like, yeah. Not everyone on a sales team is somebody that, you know, what they say is something you should react to.
Yeah, well, you know, it's got to be non-judgmental. You know, you can't, you know, I think it's a danger steering the conversation to the way that you want it to go. You're there to listen, you know, that's why you got two ears and one mouth, right? And get the honest feedback. And I told them every time I met with them, and it was honest. I learned so much by talking to them that it was more for me than it was for them. It, you know, really wasn't a gripe session. I was looking to either confirm feelings that I had about what we needed to do, what direction we needed to go, what we needed to improve on, how the morale was like, or, you know, just complete surprises like, gee, I didn't know that. Right. You know, and, you know, so the next person, I would ask about it. Right. And I kept my notes from the last time I met with them. Right. So I would ask them what was going on with their kids and whatever, all the personal stuff, and dig into, you know, some of the comments that they made last time and ask them, have we gotten better? Have we gotten worse? But it does need to be open and honest if on both parts, if it's just a bit session from them. Yeah, it's not very productive, right? or if it's just me apostolizing about my values and what the company culture is, that's not what we're sitting here talking about.
One of the things you mentioned is that the business doesn't happen internal, right? Like it happens external, outside the four walls of the office. What is your suggestion from experience to companies where, here's the scenario I see a lot, the managers, leaders, executives in their office all the time, buried, putting out fires, reacting to things, and literally just stuck internal, not realizing either outside with their team, outside of their office with their team, outside in the real world? Like, how do you make sure that's a priority, or what can leaders do to make that transition to not be so in the weeds, but also, you know, looking strategically or looking outside?
Yeah, you know, it's not typically popular, you know, with operation folks that, you know, were reporting to me at the time, but I used to say, if you're not in sales or you're not supporting sales, what are you doing? Okay. Because at the end of the day, that's really all that's important. And that encompasses a lot of different things, you know, training organizations, product development, obviously marketing, but, you know, you have to see yourself. And I think I tried to inbred in the people that they were extensions of the sales team. You know, when they had success, you had success too. You were a part of it because you were there, and you did, without your part, it wouldn't have happened. You know, it's just as important supporting sales, but let's all be clear on what we're here to do, right? We're here to make a great product and help people out there sell.
Yeah. So you say that you're not a salesperson, right?
I'm not. And
that's what you said.
Although anybody running a company has to be at least conversing with sales, right?
Conversing with sales, I said this earlier, and you know, so you listen to the podcast, is that everything in life is sales. So even as the president and leading a company, you're still some kind of sales and persuasion over people as you're leading, and everyone, you know, is focused on accomplishing the mission and the vision. So not a salesperson yourself, but looking at the whole and all of your experience you have, I'm looking at the scenario where you're selling essentially B2B to C, right? So you're selling.
It is B2B to C. Yeah. As an aside, our salespeople was the front office staff. So,
really?
You know, I used to call it the second sale. So when we would enroll, it was the doctor that made the decision, but they weren't involved in offering financing to the patient, right? It was the front office staff who then had to understand, you know, the nuances of the financing and present it to their patients. So B2B to C, but that second sale, I mean, I had 100 field salespeople. They didn't enroll. They didn't do any enrollments. Their sole job was to visit offices and get the front office staff familiar with the product and comfortable with presenting it, because they were our sales team.
Yeah, I a new phrase or term just popped in my head is B to B to E to C. So business to employees to consumer, right? Because that's what you're talking about, is that doctor or dentist says, yeah, this sounds good. You can put the flyers in my lobby. That's fine, right? Like maybe we care. Maybe we'll help people, right? And maybe that's their tepid response. And then that's when the real thing begins, because now you have to work, like you said, with the office staff. So it's not even one sale, it's multiple. And then that training, because you need them as the leverage that are out there, the army almost, if you will, that's then advocating for when, you know, a patient might need care.
Yeah, you know, going back to, you know, everybody's supporting sales, you know, our training team, we used to use existing office managers to train new our best clients in offices to train new offices after we enrolled them. So they weren't even employees.
What do you mean? So your current clients would be part of training?
They were contract labor. Contract labor. We paid them per training, And they were our advocates, their best users at a dental office. And when we enrolled a new dentist in their zip code, in their area, we would pay that office manager to go to the new office and train them on the care credit system. Talk about trust and peer-to-peer, right?
Wow. And did you get resistance from, let's say, this office manager over here? Let's say it's a dental practice saying, okay, well, now you're going to go train my competition of another dentist's office on how to do this. And like, was there any of that competition scarcity mode that would pop up?
It's honestly unique, I think, to medical, especially dental. I mean, dentists are the most wonderful people in the world. They really are. And, but we would require that dentist to sign off, you know, on the assignment. You agree that, you know, we're going to use your office manager to train another. And they loved it because they would pick up tips from the other office. They're not really a competitive bunch, you know, the dentist, right? They are very congenial and cooperative and don't see it as, you know, more business competitive. I'm giving you, I think she could be giving you state secrets that you're giving away right now.
Well, and most dentists that I know and or have gone to, they have so much business. They have so many patients they can't get to, like wait lists are crazy long, where, you know, that explains why they wouldn't have this scarcity mindset, right?
And so hey, I used to always say, if you had children, send them to dental school, okay? Don't send them to medical school, right? Because you're dealing with insurance and late night calls and all that other stuff, and they work their butts off for nothing. Dentist, a great profession to be in, especially if you're a specialist, like an orthodontist. Oh, my God.
Well, and I'm thinking about how this translates to other sales fields out there where you have the primary sale, especially if there's some kind of B2B sale, where maybe there's that main person you're wanting to enroll into whatever you're selling. Maybe it's a piece of technology, but then you have the users of that platform. You have the other stakeholders who are going to be involved. Even B2C, like you're selling this one person, but you know everyone's going to use this or everyone's got to be on board. You know, and just what that looks like and how to leverage, you know, your top customers or the lessons learned from top customers to build into your training for other ones to help with the process, right? And just make it a holistic approach.
Yeah, and, you know, going back to talking the talk of the market, right? How more intimate can you be having an existing office manager who deals with all the same issues that this new one is? How do I present, you know, how do I talk to the patient? When do I bring it up? It was just wonderful. Of course, when GE bought us, they canceled the whole thing.
No way.
They did, yes.
Why do you?
Because the lawyers were concerned about accountability, right? You know, what happens if somebody out there does something that, you know, we don't agree with and blah, blah, blah. So, yeah. I lost that battle.
Yeah, it's different when you look at that and what a big company like GE is going to be thinking and want to make sure from a compliance and regulatory and what are people, you know, especially when it comes to finance, and then you get that whole realm into it. And
right, yeah, what are they saying? I can't control them. I understood. Yeah. I got it.
Yeah.
But boy, did it help us build the business.
I bet it did. That is such a tough one for sure. When it comes to like the growing and building of things, where did you see your internal training really take off? Like, were there some things that you did where you're like, we need to build better training. We need to do something more than just hire people and hope that they know what to do.
Right.
How vital was training for internal, not your client training, not patient or doctor training, but internal?
Super important. Super important, especially for the sales team. You know, there's a lot of great tools, as you know, out there that are available, courses. And I would even go so far as to say frequency is just as important as almost as quality, right, of the sales training. Because there's a lot of different angles out there. And I budgeted every year that the sales folks would go through some kind of off-site training course, usually in person, get away from the phones, hone their skills, pick up new tips. We used to have, obviously, you know, we had over 100 folks out in the field spread across the United States. We used to have, bring them in twice a year, have parties, events, awards, all that kind of stuff. But also always included some kind of sales training because it's, you know, I think it's vitally important. And in a lot of careers, but in my opinion, especially in sales, you never learn enough. There's always something, you know, there's always something to learn from somebody else that's done it. So we invested in the salespeople. I think of it as an investment every year.
I love it. Obviously, I agree with that, and that's what I see.
I would hope so.
Successful companies, they just don't stop, right? Like, and it's interesting because a lot of times people think, oh, well, I've achieved this, or I'm good enough, and like I've got this down. And then there's another category of companies and people who realize like there's always more to learn, and they always want to be getting better. I have one client that basically, you know, has me help their team and says that's, you know, sharpen their swords constantly, like being better and better. And you look at
Absolutely. Yeah, I used to get pushback.
Sport or a field.
Yeah. Well, you spent, you know, $100,000 last year on sales training. Why do we need to do it again? Really? you know, come on.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the mindset of those kind of organizations and the results will be different than something like, you know, what you helped build with Care Credit, where it's like obvious that the investment and development into a team is what sets it apart and gets the results versus, all right, let's just, you know, hire and fire and churn people and just play that, you know, high turnover model and just hope we get something out of people, right? Which obviously no longer works, not especially not in this hiring market.
Well, you know, you asked earlier, right? How do you deal with the bureaucracy as you grow? You have to protect your salespeople. You have to protect your salespeople. You know, invest in the training, defend their commissions, right? You know, times get tough. What's the first thing somebody wants to do? All we got is cut commission or raise the tiers that they can make money or whatever. No, that's kind of the worst thing that you can do, right? Yeah. And they're an easy target, in my opinion, in big corporations as you grow, because they're a big budget item.
Correct.
I mean, it's the same thing with marketing, right? You know the old adage, right? You half of the money you spend on marketing, you're wasting. You just don't know what you have. So, you know, you just got to keep spending, keep going to the trade shows, right? Oh, you're not enrolling as many people. Well, it's branding, you know, you have to be there. It's got to be constant, it's got to be consistent, and it's got to be impactful. So, you do have to appreciate, I think, as an executive, as you grow and you've got different pressures, especially like if you're going public or, you know, those kind of organizations, you have to protect your salespeople from yourself, even from cutting and not investing in the people.
I love it. Well, let's end there. Protecting your salespeople. I might make that the title of this first part, which I think could be a good theme, you know, starting and ending this whole part one of our conversation. For part two, I'm super excited because I want to talk about what you would do. We start over the kind of work you're doing now with the companies and clients that you have. And then I also want to chat with you about the value of face-to-face sales, especially in this day and age in 2022, which I think is a fun conversation. For people tuning into this, listening on the podcast or watching the video, I know that if people want to find out more about what you do, which again, we're going to touch more on, but there'll be information in the show notes, go to maxapprovals.com. I know that's a great place. I know they can also find you on LinkedIn, Mike Testa. And I appreciate you being here, Mike, and sharing all this. I took a ton of notes. I'm excited to go through some of these on part two. But for part one, thanks for being here and sharing so much with me and the audience.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And as always, I appreciate everyone for tuning in. Again, whether it's on the audio, it's on the video, you're checking it out, you're interacting with us. I appreciate you being part of this journey to help sales and salespeople shift from this thing that the world sees as dirty to something that's a valuable profession, all while helping you make more money, close more deals in a way that feels true for you and is actually valuable to the world out there. And until next time, thank you for helping fill the world with authentic persuaders.